From KQED Public Radio, this is Capitol Notes, our weekly look at California politics, public policy, and apparently the state budget. Except,
dun, 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 dun.
Except we may now finally start to talk about something else.
Like what?
Yeah, except what the hell are we going to do?
I don't know. It's like the old married couple, right? Once the children leave, like, now what do we do?
The love is gone. The magic is gone.
I'm going to go sleep downstairs.
All right, that's Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio and the California Report. And this is, we're taping this on Thursday, the 20th. I had to look at the calendar because I had no idea what day it was given the hours. So if you're listening to this, you know the state budget deal is done. It's a deal. It's a done deal.
Done deal.
That sucker's done. And so we were up a lot of hours, and we've talked a lot of hours, you and I both, on various programs and analysis and reporting. And
Micro-analysis.
Yeah, we got to talk about that, too. I'm almost out of talking, but let's just wind it all down in the podcast.
We could have a Nixonian podcast, 18 minutes of silence, and see what happens.
Right, exactly. The foot on the recorder slipped. You know, I think there are plenty of other venues to talk about a whole lot of numbers, talk about, you know, I mean, some of that will come up in this conversation. But let's just play what impression we are left with at the end of this really torturous but ugly process. I mean, I don't think there is a person who is a fan of the process we just went through to solve a $41 billion shortfall. And I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what thoughts I'm left with, so I'm going to throw it to you, Mr. York.
I have to come up with something coherent. Thanks a lot.
You have to come up with something on the fly while I have some time to be thoughtful.
Well, one thing that has been milling around in what's left of my brain is I think what we saw, especially in the final hours of this debate, really shows kind of the policification of the state budget process. That this is the one point in the process.
Politification.
Policy.
Policy, not politics.
No.
Oh, good. Go ahead.
That this is the one point of leverage in the year where Republicans generally, or some Republicans, or a group of Republicans, actually have any influence over leverage over policy. And that this is their one shot, where you need two-thirds for everything, and all of their bills get killed throughout the year, and this is the one shot. So you end up getting all of these other sort of seemingly unrelated auxiliary things thrown into the mix. You've got environmental regulations, which are passed off as some kind of stimulus package, which, you know, take that for what it's worth. Open primary, spending cap, I mean, huge, huge government reforms. And that some of these things that are part of this deal really don't have a lot to do with the budget.
But now let me challenge you on your theory just for a moment.
Not to
disagree with it, but right. But let me ask you this. If, and I think you're exactly right, I mean, and I think anybody
that's
who
not
watches,
much of a challenge.
Well, it's the nice way of getting to it. But, I mean, anybody who watches this process, you know, really would have to agree with you that, you know, that Republicans feel so in the minority. You know, bills that never get heard in committee, that never go anywhere, ideas that they have, you know, and let's be fair, ideas that really are worth a serious substantive discussion go nowhere because they have an R after their name instead of a D. But that being said, if that process were to change and those bills were heard in serious substantive discussions through the year,
and then
would it change this ability to play that card during the budget? Because I'm not sure it would. I'm not sure it would. I mean, I'm not saying that that doesn't happen, but I'm not sure that's the reason it happens.
I'm not sure if it would change the budget process, but it complicates the budget process. And the fact that it doesn't happen throughout the year leaves Republicans sort of focused on the budget process as the one point to get the one point in the process to actually get something out of the legislative year.
The end all be all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is it. I mean, whether or not it's appropriate, whether or not it would be any different if it was any other way, I mean, this is the point. Now, I mean, keep in mind, we just came out of a presidential election where, you know, the Republican standard bearer got in the low 30s statewide. I mean, you can make a pretty good case that the reason that Republicans are in the minority and the reason that they don't get heard is that they're they're just over one third of the electorate. And that's, I mean, that's the thing that's sort of difficult. And this is what you're hearing a lot of Democrats now talking about coming out of this, really focused and determined to try to do something about the two-thirds budget requirement. This is something that I think we're going to see a lot more of. And it was perhaps fitting that earlier this week we saw an initiative hit the streets that, you know, this is going to be before California voters in 2010, no question.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't want to. It's a discussion for another podcast when we've actually slept. But
it's not fun.
I think a good journalist is skeptical, not cynical. So I want to be a skeptic, not a cynic here. But I have a hard time giving the two-thirds issue the weight that it's being given in some circles. Because the reality is, let's remind people. It's a two-thirds for a budget and a two-thirds for a tax increase.
Well, there are different versions of the initiative.
No, I know, but I'm talking about what exists in the law now, the Constitution now. And we hear this over and over from Democrats, and I'm not picking on Democrats because I've got some picking on Republicans to do in a moment over the process that we've gone through. But you hear this, we're one of only three states with a two-thirds requirement for a budget. Well, there are more states that have a two-thirds for a tax increase. I think they're 10 or 11 or something like that.
Right.
And we're not that's a small number still, but it's not as unusual. And so you get the two-thirds removed on the budget. That still wouldn't have solved this year's problem with the tax increase. You still needed $14 or $13 billion or whatever the final number is going to be in taxes. You still would have needed the Republican votes. You still would have gotten in the position you're in. And so, I always am leery of anybody who sees any one thing as the savior, as the panacea, as the whatever it would be. And the two-thirds, boy, it's the rallying cry of the left, and yet – it's like, to me, it's like redistricting or anything else where everybody says,
well, that'll
solve it.
Or open primary. Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's just it. I think we're going to get the ability to test some of these theories. It might take 4 years before the redistricting thing. And if the open primary initiative passes in 2010 and would be on the books for 2012, that's a whole other story. Perhaps we'll get to it today. But, there are a lot of people clamoring for reforms of various sorts. And frankly, I mean, there are quite a few that have either been approved by the voters of California in recent years, like with the redistricting initiative, which passed narrowly in November. And Californians are going to have an opportunity to vote on some more, and we'll see where they are.
So now that I've had to think, actually, I didn't really have to think about this one too much because I kind of sat down thinking that this is my big picture takeaway at this early juncture. I don't know a time that I have seen such such agreement across the political spectrum on a screwed up process for drafting a budget. A $42 billion fix that was really crafted behind closed doors, with all due respect to the leaders who say, well, parts of it were out there. Well, but there were all kinds of
in
things.
In spite of them.
Yeah, well, but there were all, but there were all kinds of things that were out there, and nobody ever knew the final thing. And hey, how about open primary, which is a huge political change for the state of California, to be crafted at, 9 at night, 2 in the morning, whatever time the language kept getting revised over the last 24 hours. And, left, right, business, labor, grassroots, established money people all took a hit, took a whack at the big five closed door process of this. And I think a good point was made. I think Dan Walters and the B made it, made a point that, let's be fair. The interest groups knew what was in this bill. Lawmakers did call them on the phone and say, hey, X, Y, and Z is being discussed. Could you live with that? So, this notion that we can't do it in public because the interest groups will take too many hits at it, I think that's not completely fair. But that's what I'm really left with, is that, there is this real across-the-spectrum sense that this was not the way to do this. This was a bad way to do this process.
And look, and think of who was in that room. You've got a governor who's on the record as being critical of the big five process.
Yeah.
You've got a speaker who was arguably elected speaker because she was so different from her predecessor. Her predecessor was known as someone who sort of ran the House with kind of an iron fist, and it was his way or the highway. And then Daryl Steinberg, right, the moderator and the mediator and the negotiator, who immediately put, I mean, this is the great irony that he put every member of the state Senate on the budget committee, talked about how everybody was going to be involved in the process. How many times did that committee meet during these negotiations?
I believe that would be a big goose egg.
I think it's a goose egg, right? So
it's not to say subcommittees didn't hear different things, because I know we'll get that pushback.
But your
point is valid.
But the point is, I think a lot of people felt left out of this process. And you also had the circumstance, I think we saw it play out in the Senate much, and anecdotally it was true much more in the Senate than it was in the Assembly, where the Republican leadership was not doing a good job in the Senate of communicating, or the Republican leader was not doing a good job of communicating with his members or bringing his members along to a point where he was in a position to cut a deal. I mean, it was clear that, and the fact that he was ousted this week, that Senator Cogdill, Dave Cogdill from Fresno, the former Senate
from
Republican
Modesto.
Leader. Modesto? No, Fresno.
Fresno is the lines.
No,
kind of
no,
Clovis.
Clovis.
Okay, please.
Anyway,
we're having Central Valley problems.
It's all blurred together.
We love all of you in the Central Valley. Sorry, we're not making fun of it. We're just tired.
We have Modesto issues.
We just haven't slept. Go ahead.
But the point being that Dave Cogdill, from talking to members and given the fact that he was ousted in the middle of this acrimonious fight, did not do the work that a leader is expected to do, which is to bring your caucus along.
Of course, and could he have brought that caucus
along? Then why cut a deal if you can't, if you're not in a position to deliver the votes? What are you, I mean, and it gets back to a criticism of the Big Five process, right? I mean, if these Republicans have elected a leader that essentially is not empowered to be their proxy in that room, then what's the point? I mean, not only is it going on behind closed doors, but it's useless because at the end of the day, you don't have a deal.
Yeah.
And you end up with, what's known as the pickoff strategy, or you have individual members negotiating their own deals. And that's what we saw in the last 4 or 5 days of session.
Well, and then think about that private session of how things got done. And let's play out a snippet, which gets us into the other thing that I think we should talk about. Let's play out a snippet of what happened on, I want to call it Wednesday night, but it wasn't Wednesday night, it was Thursday morning. I mean, everything happened after midnight, Wednesday, Thursday.
It's like all good things. All good things happen after midnight.
And that was the calling of the votes in the Senate on the first piece of this thing working, which was the open primary provision by Abel Maldonado, state senator from the Central Coast. The Democrats who didn't go up on that bill in the Senate, and they were angry. They were angry, one in particular, Gloria Romero, a Democrat from Los Angeles. I saw her very angry. I was trying to lip read, and I may have come across a couple of words, but I'm not sure. But she had her arms folded, very unhappy, letting Daryl Steinberg, the pro tem, know it, letting Abel Maldonado know it at one point when he came over in the discussion. Didn't want to go up on that bill. Neither did Ellen Corbett, state senator from the Bay Area.
Lonnie Hancock
from Berkeley. But the point is, these are members who didn't like the deal that was cut, and ultimately had to be called upon. You could say either arm twisting, or you could say that they were called upon to do what was right for the state in the big picture. Depends on how you want to talk about it. But again, that's the cutting a deal that doesn't reflect the views of maybe the collective views of the members. There were other members who voted for it and didn't want to vote for it. Alex Padilla made a long speech on the floor, Democrat from Los Angeles, about how he didn't want to vote for it. I think Gil Cedillo did even. So, I mean, there was – anyway, larger point, you've got to think that enough people across the spectrum are watching this process of how rank and file get a say versus leaders and private discussions, that how can anybody, with a straight face, go back and do that again that way?
Well, and as long as budgets have a $40 billion hole in them, there are going to be a couple of things that are unpopular. I think that, whether or not, you can argue whether or not the open primary had any business being part of this deal, or whether, or how it came up. But I think the reaction to it is sort of emblematic of the reaction of a lot of the other pieces of the deal, where people didn't like it. They didn't like how the deal was cut, and they were getting pressure from on the right from various groups and on the left from groups, you know, threatening recalls and whatnot if people voted certain ways. Yeah. And there's a lot of pressure because there's a lot at stake.
Well, let's talk about the big part of the deal. Let's talk about the closer, because, I mean, we could talk about all the different parts and the few lawmakers who got this and that, but let's just talk about the big elephant in the room, which is Abel Maldonado's deal that he cut to get that final 27th vote in the Senate, which
the elephant was Dave Cox's deal.
Yeah, and you can't eat an elephant with one bite or something that Senator Cox said. We had some very interesting floor speeches, and well, everybody was tired. It was a long week.
Yes.
Okay, so Maldonado asked for and got as a condition for his 27th vote. Let's give the big picture. Open primary on the special election ballot.
No,
not on the special election ballot. Sorry. The hour is late. On the 2010 ballot, if enacted, would take place in 2012. Open primary. Top two vote getters out of the primary election go on to the November election.
Right. The current system is top vote getter in every party. Yep. This would be top two.
An open primary system. Number two, a ballot measure on the special election ballot that says in a deficit year, legislators do not get a pay raise or not eligible for it and not eligible for an increase in their per diem that they have in Sacramento. Right?
Correct. And legislators, it should be noted, do not set their own salaries. It's done by an independent commission, but this would prohibit the commission from raising their pay.
This would tell the commission, no way.
No.
Number three, the cancellation of the gas excise tax increase, the 12 cents a gallon that was part of the deal to raise revenue in this. Maldonado said no way. They had to pull that out. They had to rejigger the numbers in terms of the personal income tax contribution. I get them backwards all the time. Did it end up being a surcharge instead of a surtax? Yes.
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 It was. Yes.
I get the surs wrong.
Yes.
And they had to rejigger the federal stimulus numbers that they calculated. Let's don't go into that. But we pulled out the gas tax thing. And number four, the symbolic part of this, the money for State Controller John Chung's office expansion needs, cubicles, modernization. I don't want to call it furniture because the controller's office says it's not furniture. And that's I'm with them, but I don't want to get lost in that. But this was a big old fight.
$1 million. I mean,
less than a million, about 900 and some thousand. But not say that's not real money, but again, in a $40 billion problem symbolism.
Right.
But Maldonado had made it clear he didn't like it, and that was out. And that actually was apparently an easy one. That bill was written early in this process, right, and they would have given it to him.
Sure.
But that is a tremendous number of things to get a vote. To the point where when we kept going through, is Maldonado going to be the guy? I had a hard time seeing that he was going to be the guy because I just thought, how are they going to give him all that? And yet he got all of it. The one thing he didn't get was if there's no budget enacted on time, the legislature doesn't get a paycheck because everyone started to say that was probably illegal. And right, so the deal, that got yanked. But he got everything else. I mean, so when I've been asked today who's the winners and losers, and, you know, there are a lot of programs that got cut, losers, and tax increases, Californians are losers. The winner is Abel Maldonado.
Yeah, I mean, certainly he gets his moment in the spotlight. He gets some things on the ballot that are going to be billed as good government reforms. But he took some risks politically. I mean, this goes to show sort of where we are in terms of in the partisan world of California politics. Could Abel Maldonado win a closed Republican primary now? Statewide, certainly, he tried a couple of years ago, ran for state controller, and
he's going to have to sit back and wait, though, if it gets passed for it, because they had to roll the numbers back because there was this criticism that he was doing it for his own political purposes.
And the Democrats were particularly concerned. Actually, the real reason the Democrats insisted that it be on the 2010, not the 2009 ballot, that they were worried about the governor's race. They were worried about Meg Whitman running in an open primary situation, picking off Democratic women. And, Meg Whitman is pro-choice, and she's so undefined now as a political candidate that I talked to a few Democratic senators last night who said specifically that no way were they going to go for the 2009 open primary because they thought it would threaten their hold on the governorship or their chance to recapture, I should say, depending on your view of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
But it was the kind of deal, I guess, just to put a final point on it, and then maybe talk about another thing or so. And boy, then I think our brains are going to explode.
Nap time.
Yeah. But it was the kind of deal that really does put a great big old spotlight on an ugly part of the political process, of the horse trading, of the late night writing of language, of, you know, it's not that the notion of open primaries isn't talked about by a lot of government reform advocates, but a proposal that had never seen the light of day, that had never had a committee hearing, that had never, you know, even if it mirrors ones in other states or has things that we've heard of, it's never been seen. It's never been talked about. And it's a major change in politics in California.
The great irony, of course, is that the governor has been on the record as talking about open primaries as a ballot initiative that he was prepared to go forward with. I mean, you can argue that Abel Maldonado, by holding out, all he really did was save the governor's campaign committee $1.5 million that he would have had to spend to qualify the initiative in 2010.
And the irony of that, too, given the relationship between Maldonado and Schwarzenegger, which has been tense at times. I don't know how to describe
it. It's had some peaks and valleys.
Yeah. Because Maldonado has, you know, carried some water for the governor on other issues and then didn't get some help, and we don't need to go through that whole thing. But suffice it to say,
he'll tell you. Yeah. Call Senator Maldonado's office. He'll tell you all about it.
Maybe so. Maybe at this point, maybe he should just be – he's happy with what he got. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the governor quickly, and then let's get the heck out of here nap time. Because I got to ask this question a couple of times doing interviews for NPR, for the national folks, because, of course, they always want to understand the Schwarzenegger phenomenon, the latest version of the Schwarzenegger phenomenon. What do we make of the governor's role in this, what he got out of this, how it worked for him? I don't know. What does this mean for Arnold Schwarzenegger, who I do believe more and more will have his legacy judged by the state's fiscal condition? As much as he wants to talk about the other issues, this is the issue.
Well, I think there are two different legacies. There's the internal, I get them mixed up. Inside California, I think
the California legacy.
The California legacy will be about the fiscal condition and the fiscal legacy of the state. You can argue that the national legacy might be more about environmental reforms or post-partisanism.
Yep.
Right. But I do think on that latter point, on the national image, that the legacy of the image of post-partisan Arnold Schwarzenegger endures. Here is one of the six Republicans, right, who are going to support this budget, or seven, I guess he would be the seventh. But the governor was the first Republican out of the gate to talk about tax increases, about talking about a combination of spending cuts and revenue increases, and a willingness to compromise. At the same time, he's the champion of reforms, first the redistricting initiative and now the open primaries that he had already laid out as his next target that are sold, at least, as ways to reduce partisanship in California. I think that in that way, that legacy is really untarnished. Now, you can go through the budget and parse it and look at, say, the education cuts and look at ways that they're not really cuts. A lot of them are deferred payments and, you know, and that you've got $10 billion in lottery borrowing that is still the linchpin of this whole plan working, and say that the governor still has not followed through on his initial promise when he was elected to bring fundamental change to the way the state does business, to, you know, blow up the boxes in the governor's terms and tear up the credit card, as he told us in 2004.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because, you know, one of the things that I think I don't know, you know, none of us really know the answer. This is every Californian's own opinion of how the governor has told them what he's doing and how it's working. But he has gone to the public multiple times and said, this is the fix. Things will get better after this. Things will get better after this. Now, he could argue, well, it's complicated and it's bit by bit by bit. But other people could say he's told them it would be fixed by thing X. And Prop 58 is a great example.
Right.
You know, we're tearing up the credit cards. This will make us have a balanced budget. That was 2004. Look at the budget problem since then, because Prop 58 had no teeth in it. And so time and again, you wonder how much more average Californians can absorb that and trust that he's doing it. You know, versus saying the guy's a politician, the guy says anything. And that's the most dangerous part for him, to be seen as a politician rather than what he cast himself at the beginning was, an outsider, a reformer, a crusader. Or
you can make the argument that the public has learned, along with Governor Schwarzenegger over these last 5 years, that that there is no easy fix, that all of these reforms are part of the solution, but no one reform, there is no silver bullet. You know, you can blame whatever you want. You can blame Proposition 13 or Proposition 98 or ballot box budgeting or redistricting or the closed primary or, you know, whatever you want to blame. But that the problems of governance, internal governance in California are very, very complicated.
And I think you're right. I think the question will be how are these things sold to the public? And what is the public told in the process about the challenges that lie ahead? Let's talk about what's happened on the national level. I'm not saying President Obama is wonderful and what he's done is wonderful. You can certainly debate what's happened so far. But he did several times tell people this isn't going to be fast. This isn't going to be easy.
Right.
I don't think you ever heard that out of the Arnold 1.0 version. I can do it. I can fix it. I'm going to blow up the boxes. I'm going to clean it up.
Right.
And it is not that easy. And so the question is, what do people expect you're doing? You know, even though we all know it's harder, what does the average Californian think when we're still doing this? We're still suffering through this.
And there's an interesting overlap there about whether or not what's going on nationally because of, you know, the governor, I think, said today in his press conference, with crisis comes opportunity, right? I mean, that's sort of been a mantra of his. And I think that there's something to that given what's gone on nationally and internationally, that there is a cognizance and an awareness among Californians and people across the country that the fixes aren't easy. And in some ways, that might help. That might help the governor in terms of sort of lowering the bar of expectations.
For these final 2 years of his term.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we should end it there. We're tired.
Let's do it.
You know, and we've been tweeting and, you know, by the way, the Twitter phenomenon, we'll talk about some other time,
yeah.
But my thumbs hurt
from
Twittering. And there's this fascinating article in Capital Weekly today.
We'll link to it in the pod on the KQED blog. Right?
Well, no, because that's just too self-congratulatory. No, not to mention, thank you, Anthony, for all the nice things you said about my Twittering.
Tweeting.
Checks in the mail.
Thank you, sir.
Checks, KQED coffee mug right for you.
Tote bag.
But no, we should talk about that sometime because I do think this week was an interesting phenomenon in the way that the internet and online news gets disseminated now by journalists in this era and how people follow things. But
sort of the rise of social networking and
But I'll rest my thumbs for that conversation before we do it after all the BlackBerry Twittering. So
okay.
All right. So that's it. It's time to nighty night this podcast. So
good night, Gracie.
Good night, Gracie. For Anthony York from Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED. Get some rest. See you next time.